Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. I'm glad to be back and glad to be talking about some of the issues in the news today. We're going to be talking today about the big decision handed down on the 6th of July by the New York State Court of Appeals. That's the Supreme Court, the highest court in the state of New York. And the court handed down a decision that is rightly recognized as being a real blow to those pushing for the legalization of same-sex marriage. In effect, the High Court in New York passed the issue back to the legislature, which, by the way, is where it belongs. But in the majority decision, there are some incredible statements. I'm just going to give you a hint of what is to come. Because in that majority opinion handed down by the court, there is an amazing statement that is made. Listen to this. Intuition and experience suggest that a child benefits from having before his or her eyes every day living models of what both a man and a woman are like, end quote. Now, gay rights advocates and those pushing for same-sex marriage all over the country are shocked by the decision of the New York court. They're shocked because New York is generally considered to be a liberal state. And they're shocked because a majority of the justices in New York, of all places, said there could well be a rational basis for defining marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and that alone. And then tying that to the welfare of children, it's a big story. But here's the question we're going to be discussing today. And from a Christian worldview perspective, this is really important, folks. Do we really believe, as this majority opinion states from New York State, that it is important for children to see a living role model of what it means to be a man and a woman in the home every day? Because that issue, if true, isn't just an issue of importance to the debate over same-sex marriage. It gets right to the heart of what marriage is all about. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll get to that issue in just a moment. First, a review of some of the issues in the news. I was very, very surprised. Maybe not. I hoped to be surprised. How's that for an honest statement? I hoped that the feminists would surprise me by coming out with outrage over the report that is now emerging from India about how many female unborn children, unborn baby girls, are being aborted in the wombs of Indian mothers. I was hoping that maybe they would surprise me and actually find an abortion they find unjustifiable. I was hoping for that. But that feminist outrage has not emerged. Let me tell you about the story. It comes from the Daily Mail in London. And we've known about this phenomenon. We've known this was going on in India. But only of late has there been solid statistical data to really back up hard numbers of what's going on here. Let me read to you from the Daily Mail. And this gets right to what is going on there. Even in my most conservative estimates, sex selection abortion in India now accounts for the termination of some 10 million female fetuses over the last 20 years. Let me read that number again. 10 million female fetuses aborted in India over the last 20 years. And they say that that is, if anything, a conservative estimate. This means that each year a staggering 500,000 girls have been prevented from being born. 500,000. 500,000 baby girls aborted in the womb. The preference for baby boys in India is perhaps more pronounced than anywhere else in the world. Although worldwide, parents indicate a preference, especially for the firstborn, for a boy. Asking me why I need a son instead of a daughter is like asking me why I have two eyes and not one, said one woman who emerged from an abortion clinic after having an abortion because they discovered the baby she was carrying was female. The traditional Indian preference for sons is driving this, and a culture that aids and abets abortion allows this. But I was really looking for whether or not the feminists in this country would have to speak to this. See, how can they remain silent on this question? How can feminists who claim to be speaking on behalf of women be silent about the genocide of 10 million unborn baby girls? This is sex selection abortion. This is selecting females rather than males to be aborted in the womb. Where are the feminists? You see, the feminists have so tied themselves to the ethic of abortion, saying that a woman has an unconditional, an undefinable, absolute, unrestrictable right to an abortion on whatever ground she chooses, that they now find themselves in an impossible situation. It's morally, politically, publicly impossible. I think it can't last. I think the feminists are going to have to say, look, it's wrong. It's simply wrong to select out female fetuses, unborn baby girls, to be aborted. I think they're going to have to say that. But the moment they say that, they have acknowledged that at least one abortion under this condition is wrong. The moment they admit that, the barn door's open. Then the issue becomes for them the responsibility to define which abortions are right and which abortions are wrong. And then they're going to have the moral burden of trying to say, look, sex selection abortions are wrong, but any other abortion is right. That's an untenable position. It's going to be interesting to watch this issue, but the hard facts now coming out, and the reason why this is really being blown open is because now in India, there are groups that are concerned about this. In India, as in China and in Indonesia and some other countries where sex selection abortions are rampant, it's becoming evident because there are millions and millions and millions of young men and boys who will never have a wife because the imbalance between boys and girls at birth is now so pronounced. While we're speaking about issues of life and death, I want to say that we as evangelicals, especially those as Christians approaching issues of life and death, we have a credibility problem that Michael Kinsey thinks he has detected. Michael Kinsey is not a believing Christian. He is not pro-life. He is a well-known commentator in the media. He was the founding editor of Slate magazine. And in an article published at Slate, where he's now a columnist, he suggests that if we really believed that the embryo was deserving of protection and that the embryo should not be destroyed, as the pro-life movement claims it believes, then we could not allow the celebration of in vitro fertilization technologies that require the destruction of literally hundreds of thousands of human embryos. Now, I think he's right. I think he's right on two counts. Number one, I think he's right morally. Now, he's on the wrong side, but he does define the issue exactly right. If you believe that the embryo is deserving of the protection that it would deserve by possessing human dignity, if you believe that every single life is sacred from the moment of conception, and thus that embryo is deserving of protection, then you can't say we could allow ourselves to be right in the same situation as the feminists here in terms of being in a morally impossible situation. If we say it's all right to destroy an embryo for reproductive technologies, but it's wrong for stem cell research. No, it's just wrong. Just like abortion's wrong under every circumstance, an elective abortion, so also the destruction of an embryo, a human embryo, is wrong under every circumstance. And there are too many conservative Christians out there who are unthinkingly, unreflectively using in vitro fertilization technologies in which, whether they know it or not, they are almost assured of having human embryos destroyed in the process. Just to make it very clear what we're talking about here, in the use of in vitro fertilization technologies, IVF as it's often known, test tube babies as you'll often hear the talk on the street, in order to have an adequate number of healthy embryos to be implanted in the womb, more embryos than can be implanted are created, and then they are frozen. Now, the euphemism is that they're frozen in case someone may want to use them in the future. But in fact, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of these frozen embryos that are simply going to be destroyed. Now, I have written about this. You go to my website at albertmuller.com. You'll find a multi-part article on a Christian worldview perspective on in vitro fertilization. I have, as must be obvious by now, severe concerns about it. But if you or someone you know and love as a Christian is considering the use of this technology, I would suggest they read this article because it suggests some ways of thinking about it. And it also suggests that at the very least, at the very minimum, we have to make sure that any Christian couple who allows an embryo to be created gives that embryo an opportunity to be implanted in the womb, period. We cannot be those who create embryos in order for them to be destroyed. And if we are going to be consistent, as Michael Kinsey believes many of us are not consistent, we're going to have to say that an embryo created for reproductive purposes and an embryo created for, say, embryo research, stem cell research purposes, is deserving of the same human right and human dignity and right to be protected. We as evangelical Christians have to be very careful to think about how we're thinking and to make certain that we do not commit the kind of moral hypocrisy that we can so easily see in others. We need to look back in the mirror of critical thinking and make sure that our thinking is consistent, and more than that, consistently Christian. We'll be back to talk about this decision from the New York State Court of Appeals. It's a big one. I'll look forward to the conversation with you. The phone number, 877-893-8255. Live coast to coast. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The decision handed down by the New York State Court of Appeals is really a landmark. The Court of Appeals in New York, by the way, is the equivalent of the Supreme Court in other states. It is the highest court of that jurisdiction. And what you have in this decision is some embedded language that really ought to catch our attention. Let me just walk you through it for a moment. The decision came down in a case in which several same-sex couples had sued local clerks for refusing to issue marriage licenses. They were claiming that there is a constitutional right in the New York State Constitution to same-sex marriage. And this worked its way through the courts until eventually it reached the highest court there, the Court of Appeals. And the decision was handed down on July the 6th. Now, the advocates and proponents of same-sex marriage were shocked when the New York court found that there was no basic constitutional right to same-sex marriage. But it's not only the proponents, frankly. I think those who were opposed to same-sex marriage, the defenders of traditional marriage, were equally shocked because, after all, New York is generally considered to be a liberal state. And in that state, the expectation was that there would certainly be at least some affirmation of same-sex marriage or the potential for same-sex marriage in the court's decision. But that is not what happened. I'm reading to you from the majority opinion handed down, written by Justice R.S. Smith, Jr. Listen. He said, "We hold that the New York Constitution does not compel recognition of marriages between members of the same sex. Whether such marriages should be recognized is a question to be addressed by the legislature." Now, because of that statement, the first wave of news about this decision was that the court had basically punted. The court said, "We don't want the ball. We're not going to settle the issue of same-sex marriage. We're going to give it to the legislature." And there were some who said that's an act of, some cowardice, perhaps. Well, no, number one, it's not. It's an act of judicial restraint. And whenever we see it, we ought to applaud it. This is a court saying it's not up to the courts to define marriage. It's up to the legislature. The Constitution has given the legislature that responsibility. And so, in the first place, we are not going to define marriage. We're simply going to define how the legislature has defined marriage. And we're going to affirm that the legislature has the right to do this, to define marriage, which means that, of course, the battle will shift to Albany, the state capital there in New York State, where there is certain to be a debate over the legislative definition of marriage. But the second wave of news reports and analysis coming in the wake of this decision has to do with language that is embedded later in the opinion. In order to reach the decision that there was no basic constitutional right to same-sex marriage in the New York Constitution, the court had to rule that there could be a rational basis to the legislature's definition of marriage as being only between a man and a woman. If the court found that the legislature could have no rational basis, the law could have no rational basis, then it would strike it down. But the majority in the court said there could be a rational basis for this law. They said so on two grounds. Number one, and I'm reading to you directly from the decision. Number one, the court said that there could be a rational basis based upon the fact that there needs to be a permanence in opposite-sex relationships, heterosexual relationships for the raising of children. Reading here, it says the legislature could rationally believe that this is so. But the second issue is what really caught the attention. Listen to this. I'm reading to you directly from the opinion, written majority opinion by Justice Smith of the New York State Court of Appeals. The legislature, he says, could rationally believe that it is better, other things being equal, for children to grow up with both a mother and a father. Intuition and experience suggest that a child benefits from having before his or her eyes every day living models of what both a man and a woman are like. Bombshell, folks. That's big. Number one, this justice didn't say, some have argued. He didn't say, some have said. He didn't cite some authority who he then quotes. He states this positively as his opinion. That's remarkable. That's why in the second wave you have articles such as that in the New York Times coming out and saying this is a huge blow to same-sex marriage. New York Times, for gay rights movement, a key setback. Also Washington Post, other major news articles and newspapers coming out saying, look, this is a big blow because it's a hammer blow to the argument. That's the big issue. It's not just procedural. This is principial. It's a matter of principle that's involved here. This justice says, in his majority opinion, this, and this is so refreshing because generally we kind of read these very cogent arguments in what tragically appear to be in so many cases minority opinions. This is the majority opinion. He goes on to say, after suggesting that intuition and experience suggest that a child benefits from having before his eyes every day living models of what both a man and a woman are like, he went on and said, it is obvious that there are exceptions to this general rule. Some children who never know their fathers or their mothers, who do far better than some who grow up with parents of both sexes, but the legislature could find that the general rule will usually hold. Now, that sentence is also a blockbuster, because that sentence implicitly says, you don't create the definition of marriage on the exceptions. You create the definition on the general rule. You can always come up with exceptions. Human life being as complex as it is, human beings being as they are, there are almost an infinite number of exceptions. But you create the rule. You create the law on the general terms. That, too, is very, very important. I want to open the phones. 877-893-8255 is the number. 877-893-TALK. Let's go at this issue and let's answer this justice. Do you believe that it is by intuition and experience that we learn that a child benefits from having before his eyes every day living models of what both a man and a woman are like? You see, we as Christians believe that. But we believe it not just on the basis of intuition and experience, but on the basis of revelation. We believe it because we believe that marriage is not simply a cultural construct. It's a divine gift. And God's creation of humanity as male and female, man and woman, and in marriage as husband and wife, then with children as mother and father. We believe that that is a part of God's plan for us, for our good, for our health. The number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Just how important do you think this is? You think this judge is out on a limb? You think this judge is talking about a world that no longer exists? Do you think this judge is homophobic? Or do you think this judge is just speaking out of common moral wisdom that humanity has known for a very, very long time? I would count this judge's opinion as a rare and very, very noteworthy example of judicial honor and courage. Because I guarantee you, this judge, in making these statements, this court, in ruling this way by a majority, has put itself on the side of what I believe to be human history and what is good and wholesome and healthy for humanity. But he has certainly painted himself politically incorrect for all those who are watching among the cultural elite. The Los Angeles Times, the editors opined on this. I wrote about this on my blog, The Media Elite Strikes Again. They came out saying that the New York court was moving in the opposite direction of history and justice on same-sex marriage. What do you think? Who's out of touch? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The issue here is not just same-sex marriage. That's what's so important. It's marriage. It's the difference between a man and a woman. It's the need of children for both a mother and a father. This doesn't just impact same-sex couples. It's a reminder of the responsibility of heterosexual couples to live out in faithfulness what it means to be mom and dad, husband and wife, before their children. To be there every day in the home, living it out. 877-893-8255 is the number. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. This is the Albert Mohler Program. We're looking at this decision from the New York State Court of Appeals, a decision on same-sex marriage, a decision that there is no basic constitutional right to same-sex marriage in the state of New York. Coming from a liberal state and from that state's highest court, this is big, big news. But as I tried to walk us through this issue, the first wave of news was just that the decision happened. That was shocking enough. The second wave is what the decision actually said. And what the majority opinion stated is that there is, and could well be, in the guarded language of this court, a rational basis for believing that it is important for children to be raised by heterosexual couples. Let me just read to you this again. You have here the statement, the legislature could rationally believe that it is better, among other things, as other things being equal, for children to grow up with both a mother and a father. Intuition and experience suggest that a child benefits from having before his or her eyes every day living models of what both a man and a woman are like. Now, the decision, as I said, came as quite a shock. Let me just read to you from the New York Times. Monty Stewart, president of the Marriage Law Foundation, that's a group against same-sex marriage, said, when people look back and write the history of this issue, they will view the New York decision as the Gettysburg in this big contest. On the other hand, Shannon Minter, legal director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, said, New York just reminded us that we'll have to go through a long period of conflict and confusion before we make it to the other side. Both sides agree that the New York decision will influence other state courts, and that's huge, too. As a matter of fact, what the proponents of same-sex marriage fear is that the New York decision could influence the United States Supreme Court, because ultimately, we all know this issue will arrive at this nation's highest court. Now, the editors of the Los Angeles Times, just before we went into the break, I mentioned this, they wrote an editorial against the decisions in both New York and Georgia that took place the same week. By a 4-2 vote, the New York Court of Appeals ruling that the limitation of marriage to heterosexual couples was a, quote, long-accepted restriction that was not based solely on, quote, ignorance and prejudice against homosexuals was the big issue for the editors of the L.A. Times. But they wrote in such scathing language. They wrote, for instance, adding insult to injury. An opinion signed by three of the judges in the majority ruled that it was rational for the legislature to ban same-sex marriage in the interest of protecting children. So we just read the sentence from the opinion. You heard it yourself. And now the Los Angeles Times editors say that that very statement adds insult to injury. The media elite seem constantly determined to show themselves to be out of step with the American people. The American people, by and large, a vast majority, understand what marriage is. Every time the issue of marriage has come up, same-sex marriage, in terms of state initiatives, constitutional amendments, and all the rest, traditional marriage, heterosexual marriage, has been affirmed by the voters by an overwhelming margin. That's why these issues are really being pushed in the courts, because that's the only way the proponents of same-sex marriage are going to get their way. Now, let me just read to you again. This is what they say. Gay rights activists shouldn't underestimate the challenge ahead. In Georgia, the ban on same-sex marriages upheld last week passed with 76% of the vote. Bingo, by the way. Meanwhile, even politicians who support gay rights consider it political suicide to mention the M word, and conservatives continue to score points with the fallacious argument, this is the LA Times again, that legalizing same-sex marriage would make heterosexual marriage less attractive or even more absurdly damage the religious sacrament of matrimony, end quote. You know, that's just editorial garbage. But listen to the last paragraph. It took the Supreme Court until 1967, they put an exclamation point there, to strike down odiously racist anti-miscegenation laws. Someday we'll look back on the anti-gay marriage hysteria with the same revulsion. Until then, with the high court seemingly disinclined to address marriage, states such as California should take the lead. Now listen to that last language again. We will look back someday, they say, on the anti-gay marriage hysteria. Are you hysterical? Anyone you know hysterical? Does this court sound hysterical? They say we will look back on the anti-gay marriage hysteria with the same revulsion. I don't think so. But what do you think? The number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The New York State Court of Appeals, the highest court in the state of New York, has ruled that there could well be a rational basis for limiting marriage to the union of a man and a woman, precisely because that is the arrangement that is best for raising children. It is good. Reason and experience teach, said the justice writing the majority opinion, that a boy and a girl benefit from seeing a father and a mother on a daily basis. Call and tell me what you think. The number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Do we believe this or not? That's the big question. We know that this judge does. I think we believe it and then some. 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, this decision is really big for a lot of reasons, but I think people are going to look back and just be amazed that at this particular time, you're talking July 6, 2006, this issue is not new. It's been debated for some time. The momentum's been building, at least in certainly the East and West Coast areas, for the exceptions to same-sex marriage, and now all this comes about. The phone number is 877-893-8255. I want you to hear something, because this really gets to the heart of the issue. This is Roberta Kaplan, lawyer for the gay plaintiffs in the case. She was speaking on CNN's Situation Room, and she's responding to the majority opinion's statement that intuition and experience suggest that a boy and a girl benefit from having a mother and a father in the home. Let's listen to what she has to say.
The scientific evidence that's out there is absolutely uniform and consistent, that there's absolutely no difference to children between being raised in a family with a mother and a father.
Well, I could take that apart so many different ways. Number one, the scientific evidence out there is uniform. Number one, scientific evidence is never uniform. But on the other hand, what kind of scientific evidence and what kind of scientist is doing the work producing this evidence? But let's not even go there. She just says, look, that argument's fallacious. It makes no difference. That's her whole point. It makes no difference whether a child is raised by a heterosexual couple or a homosexual couple. Do you really believe that? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where Lisa's on the phone, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi, I just have a comment or a question. If the Supreme Court is saying that it is beneficial for children to each day see a male and a female as a mother and father, then how does that affect single parents? Does that mean that they are not good for raising children?
Now, Lisa, hang with me here for a minute. You may not have heard when I read the extended statement that comes from this. Let me go back and read it. Rather than try to summarize it, maybe it'd be better for me just to allow the justice that wrote this to do it on his own, because he directly addressed that issue. And let me read here. He says, the legislature could rationally believe that it is better, among other things, or other things being equal, for children to grow up with both a mother and a father. Intuition and experience suggest that a child benefits from having before his or her eyes every day living models of what both a man and a woman are like. It goes on to say, it is obvious that there are exceptions to this general rule. Some children who never know their fathers or their mothers, et cetera, et cetera. So, Lisa, I think the justice here is making the same point I would want to make, which is we recognize that there are exceptions. There are situations of brokenness. There are situations of certainly single parents doing a brave job of raising their children. But I would still have to say that I believe that it is better, it's advantageous for a child to have both a mother and a father. And I think most single parents would say it would be advantageous, wouldn't you?
And yes, I do agree. It's just I know that that's the first thing I thought of, and I wondered how many single parents out there may have had self-doubt all of a sudden. It's like, well, what about me?
Right. Well, I the last thing we want to do is put self-doubt into this situation for any parent, single parent bravely trying to do this work. But I think honesty requires us just to come back again and again to say there is a general rule here. There is a general fact, a principle that children need and benefit from having both a mother and a father. Now, from time immemorial, there has been the death of parents, the separation of parents. Fathers have had to go to war. Mothers have had to go take care of other relatives. I mean, there are all kinds of situations in which these things can happen. And now there is the phenomenon of widespread single parenting. But I think we have to come back as Christians again and again to say there is a boilerplate gift of marriage that includes a man and a woman, and of the family that includes a mother and a father. Where brokenness exists, we'll have to call that what it is. And we're going to have to encourage people who are in that kind of situation to do the very best they can under the circumstances. We're going to have to honor them for doing their very best, as I would honor you as a single mom for doing all you can do in the raising of your children. But I received an interesting email, by the way, Lisa, that came to me just the other day. And it came to me from a widow of one of our soldiers. And I almost identified the unit, but I did not have her permission, so I'm not going to do that. But it's a well-known unit that suffered tremendous casualties in the war on terror. And she wrote me having two young sons, and she said, I know every day my sons need their father, but he's not here. And she said, I'm going to do the very best I can. But she was responding to this very argument that it doesn't matter. She says, it does matter. As the mother of boys, I have to tell you, it really does matter. But, you know, this is a situation in which there is no moral issue there involved for her. But still, the situation is such that she honestly knows she can't do everything a dad would do. She can't be a man. But she's going to be the very best mom she can be. And I believe that God will give her sons grace and mercy, as he will give it to her as well in that great task. And I pray the very same thing for you, Lisa, and I appreciate your call. That's one of those questions that does immediately come to mind. What is this court saying? This court is not saying a single parent shouldn't have the right to parent. It is saying that the state, the government, has a responsibility to say it is advantageous for children, if at all possible, to have a mom and a dad. And I think they're right. I appreciate your call. Let's go to Terry, listening on WFIA, calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Terry.
Yes, Dr. Mueller, we love you in Louisville. We're glad we have you here. And I have one quick comment, and that is 20 or 30 years ago, all the psychologists said that it didn't matter to a child whether they were raised in a divorced family or not. It wouldn't hurt them one bit, and things would be just the same. Well, they've retracted that statement, and they've decided now that it really isn't so good. And I'm just saying, if they're deciding now that children can be raised by a homosexual couple, are we going to have to wait 20 or 30 years for them to find out that they were wrong?
Terry, what a great point. Thank you, by the way, for that very kind comment. I really am struck by what you said there, because I had not yet jumped to that point, and you really helped us by doing that. And I love the way you ended by saying, is it going to take 20 or 30 years to get there? You know, it strikes me, Terry, that one of the reasons it took 20 or 30 years to get there on the divorce question is that it takes 20 or 30 years for a generation to grow up and say, look, the scientific studies were bunk. They were bogus. They're worthless. Let me tell you about what my life was like. I have never yet met a young man who didn't have a father who said to me, I'm really glad of that. Or whose parents got divorced, who said, you know, I really think it was a great thing they got divorced. There is a big study out called The Myth of the Good Divorce. And Terry, it makes your point very, very clearly. And that is that it was a myth, but it was a myth that this society bought, this culture really bought into it. And now what we hear from is not just the scientific studies, but the children who have now grown up to be adults who can now speak for themselves and say, there is nothing good about it. Thanks for the call, Terry, and thanks for all of you for listening. This is a big issue. We're going to return to it from time to time as events in the news really raise this issue again. But I want to say, as one Christian commentator, I am very thankful for this court in New York that made such a profound statement on the basis of their own moral intuition and legal judgment that it is advantageous for children to have both a mom and a dad. Isn't it weird to live in a time in which that makes the front page of the New York Times? That's where we are, and I'll be right back. Well, this is the season of weddings, and when we're talking about marriage, we might as well reflect on the fact that there are a whole lot of weddings going on right now. As a matter of fact, my wife and family and I are going to be participating and attending in no less than 3 weddings in 8 days, just this week or so. And I'm going to be performing one of them, and we're going to be attending 2 of them, and it is a great, happy, glorious, wonderful occasion in each case. committed Christian young people coming together, getting married, making their vows to each other. I know these young people. I know their families. And because of that, this is just an occasion of great, great joy. But these days, it also amounts to something of a moral revolution. The Times, which is the leading newspaper in London, reports that marriage is making a comeback among the young, and especially among young women in Great Britain. Let me just read to you from the article that was published just this past Sunday. Quote, the idea of marriage being the edgy, adventurous choice is a common theme among the newly married and the young. Clover Stroud, who married at 24 when none of her friends was anywhere close to making such a serious step, said it felt, quote, like a brave, life-affirming choice. Anything less seemed a bit lazy, end quote. She went on and she said the background where she grew up was, I don't believe in marriage, and she subscribed to it herself wholeheartedly until she met the man she wanted to spend the rest of her life with. Quote, a lot of people said, why not just live together? And I did find that quite a hard question to answer. I suppose there's an absoluteness about marriage, and I think it is completely different for our generation. All the reasons why marriage was considered to be restrictive have evaporated, if you're coming at it from the place that we are. So now it's okay to want a little bit of that bondage, because it imposes a structure. I actually feel more empowered by being married, end quote. Well, we started out this program by saying that just that one sentence from the decision of the New York State Court of Appeals was dynamite. So's this, right here in this story. Here is a young woman in Great Britain who says, look, marriage does impose an authority, an absoluteness. She says it has a structure, it imposes a structure, but she says, I actually feel more empowered by being married. Well, for good reason. Because she now is connected to a man, not by the fact that they are cohabitating and having sexual relations with each other, but because they are bound by public and common vows to each other. They belong now to each other. They're not just associated with each other. They are bound together by covenant. Yes, there is an absoluteness to that, and it does impose a structure. And that's why this young woman, speaking for so many others, says, I want to be a moral revolutionary in getting married. Not just cohabitation, not just easy love and all that goes with it. I want a ring on my finger, and I want a husband in the house. That in itself is a revolutionary statement. God bless this young woman for making it, the Times for writing this article, and all those young people right now who are getting ready to make those vows and to keep them. Thanks for listening, folks. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.